Thank you. My name is Chet Parker, and I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 25th of 1984, and my home group is the College Park Triangle Group in Orlando, Florida. And I would like to thank Fred and Martha for asking me to participate in this meeting. I have come to learn that it is a privilege to be allowed to participate in any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not always know that. With Ken's introduction, something else that I didn't know was that it's very important that I do what I say I'm going to do when I say I'm going to do it. And part of that is when I make a commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous that I keep it, and I keep all of it. And I did not know that when I first got here. About 2 years ago, I was up at Jekyll Island in the fall, and Johnny from Long Beach was putting on a big book study. And he pointed out something in the third chapter of the big book that I had read. I know I'd read it, but it hadn't made any sense. And it hadn't had the impact that he brought out. And that is where it says, we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. That is the first step of recovery. In the last 15 and a half years, I have made that statement with my mouth with varying degrees of knowledge and sincerity. And I am here to tell you that admitting to my innermost self that I am an alcoholic was indeed the beginning of my recovery. Unfortunately, after I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I started to question whether or not I fit the criteria. Because everybody knows that alcoholism and alcoholics drink a lot of alcohol and bad things happen to them. And when I came here, I thought I was a heavy drinker. In fact, I took pride on that. That was part of my persona that I had developed, that I was a heavy drinking sort of guy, sort of a pirate of the Broadway, and I could knock him down with anybody. But I got here and found that I was among the real pros. You know, I got here and I listened to people who slept under the bridge and drank Sterno strained through Merita bread. That ain't in my story. I never drank Sterno, strained or unstrained. I heard people get up in the morning and drink a quart of warm vodka or a quart of warm gin. That ain't in my story. I really wasn't much of a gin or a vodka drinker. So I started to question whether or not I was an alcoholic. But I'm a good mimic. I'm a good mimic. And when I first started to come to meetings, I heard people say, you know, my name is Ken, I'm an alcoholic. My name is Bob, I'm an alcoholic. And I like to fit in. So I said, my name is Chet and I'm an alcoholic. Then I started to hear people say, my name is Ron and I have a problem with alcohol. Or, you know, my name is Bill and I have a desire to stop drinking. Well, I like that, so I started saying things like that too. And I got to tell you that there is a world of difference between Chet Parker, an alcoholic, and Chet Parker, a man who has a problem with alcohol, and Chet Parker, a man who has a desire to stop drink. Big difference. I am kind of a panty waist drinker. And it's tough to be an alcoholic if you're a panty. Tough to be an alcoholic in Alcoholics Anonymous if you're a panty waist drinker. Not only that, nothing particularly bad ever happened to me. You know, it ain't much of a story. When I was about 4 years sober, somebody gave me a tape of a fellow from California by the name of Clancy. And I'll tell you, that tape changed my life. I was about at the point where I was ready to leave AA. I had gotten a lot of benefits from not drinking, and I didn't understand what this thing was all about. And when I listened to that tape, he answered questions that I had not even put words to. And I'm glad that Bob and Ruth are here, because when I thanked Fred and Martha, one of the things I didn't say was I wanted to thank them for carrying on the tradition that Bob and Ruth started of Jekyll Island. And of course, when I first got sober, within my first 3 months, I was given three tapes. And they were the old B&R tapes. And I played those tapes until they were smooth. And I have been a tape person ever since. And I wanted to thank Bob and Ruth for starting this roundup and keeping it going for a lot of years. But not only did Clancy's tape answer questions for me, when I listened to it, I said, now there's an alcoholic. There's a story. There's a guy who was sleeping in all-night theaters on Skid Row. Alcohol had cost him his home, his family, his car, his front teeth. When he tried to go down and sell blood on October 31st, 1958, they wouldn't take his blood. He'd lost his health. And he walked and he slept in an abandoned car. Now, it does not take a rocket scientist to look at that man and say, buddy, you're an alcoholic. But 26 years later, on October 31st, 1984, I walked out of the Polk County Courthouse in Bartow, Florida, where I had pled guilty to a kind of a misunderstanding with the law that had happened on July 24th of 1984. And when I walked out of the courthouse, I had my clothes, I had my house, I had my family, I had my job. I didn't have my car, but insurance was in the process of taking care of that. And how can this man be an alcoholic? Well, I are. And let me tell you how I have come to know that I are. I was born on a small island, or I guess a fairly large island, off of San Diego in Southern California by the name of Coronado. My father was a career Navy pilot. He was stationed at Coronado, having just come back from flying fighter planes in the South Pacific during World War II. He was a decorated war hero. My mother quit work. She had been an airline attendant when they met. I was a desired child. I was a loved child. After a very short period of time in California, we moved to Rhode Island, where my father was in the first squadron of jet planes that were being deployed on aircraft carriers. When I grew up, there were plaques in our house that said that he was the 10th man to land a Phantom on an aircraft carrier and the 13th man to land a Banshee. My father was and is a hero to me. He enlisted in the Navy when he was 18. He grew up in Bartow, Florida. My grandfather was the superintendent of education for Polk County, but he had invested in orange groves right at the Depression, and the family had been wiped out. There was no money to go to college. He wanted to fly, and his father said, the only way you're going to do that is to join the Navy. He enlisted as a seaman recruit, and when I was born, because of the war, he was an officer. He'd been promoted to lieutenant. After we left Rhode Island, we went to St. Louis, where he was a test pilot, a Navy test pilot for probably about a year and a half, 2 years with McDonald Aircraft Company. When I was three or four, we moved to Orlando. My parents bought a piece of property on a lake and built a house, and that has been their house, my mother's house now, for the last 60 years. And even though I was a Navy brat, from the time we built that house, nobody else lived in it, and that was home. We may have been living somewhere else in Virginia or Pensacola, but that was just temporary. Orlando was home. So I wasn't even, I had roots that my parents gave me, security. And I had an idyllic childhood. There was no abuse, there was no deprivation. You know, nothing would indicate that this kid is on his way to alcoholism. Got to be about 12 years old, and I discovered girls. And the serpent was loose in the garden. Because not only did I discover that I liked girls, I discovered that girls did not like me. And not only did girls not like me, not many other people did either. And I developed from about the age of 12 the idea that I was not enough. And I desperately wanted to be loved and liked and admired. And I didn't know what to attribute it to, so I figured what I would blame it on would be my parents. You know, they were handy. And I noticed that all the popular guys had really nice clothes. And at that time, my dad had just retired from the Navy. He was establishing a second career as an insurance salesman. And while we were not poor, money was a little tight. And my parents had priorities like education, a house. You know, they weren't indulging me in my fads of clothing, but that was why I was unpopular. And so I responded by really turning into a sullen, obnoxious brat. I did not realize that that's the definition of adolescence and that it happens to everybody. I thought I was special. And I had been told from first grade, I had taken some tests in first grade, and I had been told, not what the scores were, but that I really did well and that people were really expecting a lot from me, that I had a lot of potential. And I am here to tell you that that potential is largely intact today. Because I was damned if I was going to do anything. And so I was drifting through school, making, you know, gentlemen C's before gentlemen C's became popular. And I had grown up on naval air stations, and I loved, the sound of a jet airplane winding up just... It just gets to me, still does to this day. And I had expressed the desire that I was going to follow in my father's footsteps, that I was going to go to Annapolis. They came to me in my senior year and said, "Do you still want to go to Annapolis?" And I sullenly said, "Yeah." And they said, "Well, good, because we've got this plan. There's this military school in New Jersey, And they, with your grades, you ain't going nowhere. You're not getting any congressional appointment to anything. But this particular school has two honor school appointments to the academy. And if you do well there, that's another way to get in. Do you want to go?" Oh, yeah, I suppose. Because I knew something. I knew, this was in August, I knew they were not going to let me in. Because school started in 3 weeks. And I had a good friend who had been applying to private schools to get away from his father for a long time, and he barely slid in to a private school in Jacksonville called Bowles 2 months before. So I knew I did not have to rock the boat. It wasn't going to happen. So we took a family car trip up to New Jersey, Toms River, and I looked at this school. And God, it was horrible. Paint was peeling off the wall. It was painted sort of a battleship gray. And it was, God, what a hellhole. But not to worry. not to worry. And we're pushing September 1st now. We get home and the letter accepting me beat us home. So I spent my senior year, the first part of my senior year, as the lowest ranking plebe, dressed in a black rubber raincoat because it was raining and we had to learn how to march inside. And we had to run between classes, in your first month or two. And finally, a senior classman called me over and said, Parker, what's this I hear about your father being the commander of the George Washington? I went, what? It turns out that there was a Captain Parker who was the commanding officer of one of the first nuclear-powered submarines. And so when Captain Parker's son applied to this school, they assumed that it was the same one. A horrible case of mistaken identity. At this point, I had absolutely no contact with alcohol. I was 17 years old, and it was not in the family. It was not around me. I do not believe there is any obvious alcoholism in my family. But when I was a senior, a group of us decided that for a weekend to prove that we were men, sort of a rite of passage, we would go up to New York and get drunk. Because you could drink in New York at 18. And if you wore a uniform, and our uniforms look very much like naval officer uniforms, nobody carded you. So with this plan, I think four or five of us took the bus, went up to New York one weekend in March, and did exactly what we intended to do. And I got drunk. I mean, I drank beer and I drank wine, and we ordered Manhattans from room service. And at that time, Playboy, which we read only for the articles, had these little recipes from Southern Comfort in the magazine. And being a very sophisticated reader of Playboy, I assumed that Southern Comfort was the man's drink, so we bought some of that. Sick as a dog. I probably had a little bit of a blackout, but I'm not sure about that. And the next day woke up with a god-awful hangover. You know, to the one of the hangovers where you put the water in the tub and you just kind of lie there and put your head under and your nose, just make it go away. And we took the bus back to New Jersey and it's bouncing up and down, the stomach's going up and down. And I said, that's it. That's bad stuff. I used to tell that story that I was an alcoholic from the beginning because my first experience with alcohol led to a drunk. I no longer believe that. I no longer believe that. I have come to believe that the hallmark of alcoholism is an inability to control the drinking. And I did exactly what I intended to do. I intended to go up and get drunk, and I got drunk. I finished out that year. I found out that the Naval Academy would not accept me because at that point you had to have 20/20 vision. And I had done absolutely nothing to prepare myself for college other than that wishful thinking. So when it came time, we're now pushing June, I wrote to the University of Florida, and they wouldn't even send me an application. It was so late. And so this little school in Louisiana accepted me. Now, my friend from Orlando was going to go there, and that was the only other school I'd heard of, so I applied to Tulane, and they accepted me. And so we went down to New Orleans to take a look at the school, and my parents were really excited. My dad had never gone to college, and, you know, he was really pumped, And I wouldn't give them, anything. I was just as sullen as I ever was. I was embarrassed to walk into the university center with my parents. I thought people were looking at me. What a dweeb with his parents. I just wanted them to go away. Leave me alone. Just leave me alone. Now, during that summer, I drank a little bit. The drinking age in Florida at the time was 21. I did not have a fake ID card, so occasionally friends would have some beer that they had bought, and they would give me some, and I really didn't like it. It had to be really, really cold, and maybe I could get it down, and most of the time I wouldn't even finish it. So I got to college, and I looked around, and it seemed that the guys that were really cool, were big drinkers. At that time, beer came in, cans, and they'd have chug-a-lug parties where they would hold the beer up and then take a can opener and put a hole in the bottom so it would just pour out into their mouth. I thought that was cool. That was the neatest thing. So I hung with it, and I drank, and I didn't like it, but I drank, because I'm persistent, if nothing else. And my drinking increased, And I had some experiences. I joined a fraternity, and I had some experiences passing out before the football game. And having, these blackout experiences where you remember bits and pieces, but not the whole thing. But the first time that I can tell you that I crossed over the line to uncontrolled drinking was within 4 years from the time that I started. The Vietnam War was going on. I was about ready to graduate from college. That I would have been draft bait. But at that time, if you stayed in school, you could keep your 2S deferment. So I looked around, and there was a law school at this college. And so I took the law school exams, did fairly well, and applied for early admission and got accepted. So I started law school a half a year out of phase. Everybody else knew more than me. And so I did what I normally do when confronted with a tough situation. I just skipped out mentally and physically. I didn't go to class. I'd go out to the lake, Lake Pontchartrain, buy a quart of beer, and sit out there and read mystery books. And all of a sudden, it was final exam time. And I'm not stupid. I knew I wasn't prepared. So I made a solemn oath. I am not going to drink for 2 weeks while I prepare for these exams. I made that solemn oath on Friday. And my parents had said that they would come to New Orleans and visit on Sunday, but some bad weather kept them from getting up. So I called my girlfriend at the time and I said, And this was the type of rationale. Well, if my parents had come to visit us, we would have gone to dinner. Let's go to dinner. And if we had gone to dinner with my parents just to be sociable, we would have had a drink. So let's have a drink. So my solemn oath lasted 2 days. And I had had an accident in my car. I drove a Volkswagen at the time, and I'd run into the back of somebody, so I had no headlights. And so wherever I had to be back before dark. And I was sitting there. I had the intention of going out there to have 2 drinks and get back and study. And I remember sitting on a bar stool, looking out the door and watching the sun go down. And my last conscious thought was, you better get out of here because you don't have any headlights. The next thing I knew, the next conscious thought I had was 3 o'clock in the morning. I was back in bed in my room. And I have no idea from that day to this how I got there. I have no idea how I got there. Obviously, I drove. My car was in the parking lot. I intended not to get drunk. All the circumstances said, don't get drunk. I had one or two beers, and I got drunk anyway. I had crossed over that line. 16 years later, I did a lot of drinking between those times. 16 years later, I had another incident where I can definitely say I was out of control. I was at that time practicing law in Orlando. I had a particularly difficult case, criminal case that I was defending of electronics fraud. I didn't have much of a defense because there wasn't much of a defense, but I knew I had to be sharp. We went out to dinner with some friends just to be sociable. Just to be sociable, I had a glass of wine with dinner. The next thing I knew, it was 3 o'clock in the morning. I woke up, I was so drunk, I couldn't function. I guess I was in an early stage of alcohol poisoning. I had drunk so much. I stumbled into court, barely, I don't know how I functioned and did not really screw this guy over. It was luck. Circumstances said stay sober. My intention was stay sober. I had a drink and I got drunk. Like I say, there was a lot of drinking in between, but those instances really stand out in my mind. I'll tell you later, I've had kind of a love-hate affair with the practice of law over the years. I didn't go into it with the purest of motives. But I have never done anything that would bring dishonor to the profession, and I have never done anything to hurt a client intentionally. But when I did that, it really scared me. So, I graduated from law school and had been accepted to the Navy JAG program. This is a guy who was trying to stay out of Vietnam. I'd had an opportunity to get in, and I'd been accepted. What I found out later was that the reason they accepted me was because my father was a retired Navy captain, military war hero, and they figured that a guy like that would be a good asset and a career officer. Did I fool them? I got there with guys who were really, really good. Now, these guys were the cream of their crop because the selection process was so high. So many people wanted to get in, they could pick and choose. And I knew I didn't belong. I knew I wasn't good enough. But the one thing that had kept the brakes on my drinking was gone. I now had money. I had all the money that I could, and I spent every day drinking. I don't know that I got drunk every day. I don't know how you define that, but I drank every day. And at some point, alcohol started working as my crutch. That when I had those feelings of inadequacy, I could go to the club, I could have some drinks, and I felt more than enough. I'd gotten married. I had to be drunk to get married because I knew it wasn't right. But I did it anyway because you don't want to let them down. And besides, maybe she loved me enough that it would work out. But I had this feeling of being unloved. And when I drank, I felt loved. My naval career was not stellar. I mean, why be good if you can feel good? You know? Why do preparation if you can drink and feel prepared? I came to the end of 4 years, and I had taken a trip out to San Francisco, and I loved San Francisco. I had just fallen in love with it. So when it came near time to get out, I called up my man in Washington, and I said, I'll tell you what, I'll give you 4 more years. I'll stay in for 4 more years if you will send me to San Francisco. And what he said to me was, Chet, not only will we not send you to San Francisco, we don't want you to stay in. They were begging for people, but they didn't want me. And they were right. So I came back to Orlando and took the only job that I could, which was an assistant state attorney prosecuting drunk driving cases. What else? Alcohol had gradually become the most important thing in my life. Alcohol, I would not go to a wedding because they would not serve the real stuff right away. And I didn't want to be in that situation. The day that we left Great Lakes, which is where I spent 4 years, my son had been born. He was about a year old, and he was quite sick. Couldn't stop the vomiting. He was dehydrated. My wife put him on an airplane in O'Hare, and they immediately put him in the Naval Hospital down in Orlando. Got an IV in him, got him hydrated. I was driving cars down from Chicago to Orlando in preparation of the move, and I went in to the hospital to see my son. First time I'd seen my son in several days because he was so sick. And he was standing there. I remember they had the rails around the hospital beds. And they had given him a pair of bunny pajamas with the little feet in them. And he was standing. And he was so excited to see me. And I couldn't wait to get out of there. I did a 3-minute turnaround. Hi, how you doing? I'm out of here. Because right next to the hospital was the golf course. And they served beer at the golf course. Alcohol was more important to me than my son. Years later, I divorced my wife. I knew that the only thing that was holding me back from being the hip, slick, cool man about town that I wanted to be was this bad marriage. So I got rid of her. We had 2 children by this time. Now, where they came from, I'm not sure. I think I had something to do with it, but they were not planned. And the question was, what do we do with those children? Well, obviously, I didn't want them. So I got a lawyer, because everybody knows that a lawyer who represents himself has a fool for the client. And we proposed 3 plans. One was that she keep the kid, she keep the house. Plan 2 was she keep the kid, we sell the house. Plan 3 was that I keep the kids and move back into the house. And my lawyer said, are you sure that you want to do this? I said, not to worry. Not to worry. We're just putting that one in to make it complete. There's no way that she'll buy that one. 2 months later, I was a single father of a 6- and 9-year-old boy living in this house. My kids were playing soccer. And I would take them to soccer practice after work. And as soon as I would drop them at soccer practice, I would go back to the bar. And I would drink until it was time to pick them up. And one afternoon, I was sitting there watching the sun go down, thinking, you know, I really need to be over to pick my kids up. But it was a choice. Do I pick my kids up on time, or do I get that last cheap drink? Took the last cheap drink at happy hour, of course. I got there well after dark. My two kids were the only ones at the soccer field with one coach who was mad at me. Can you imagine him being mad at me? Alcohol was more important than my children. I've heard many people talk about leaving their children for a day, for a week, for a month. I've come to learn that the difference between 15 minutes and a year is just a matter of degree. Just a matter of degree. I quit that job with the state attorney's office because they had some questions about my drinking with the defense lawyers. And I said, you can't tell me what to do. I quit. I got to tell you, that's not how you start a professional practice. Tell you about my last drunk and then move on, because I think it talks a lot. After I got rid of my first wife, I looked for love, looked for a relationship that would make me complete. Met this woman, dated her for a couple years, took her to a lovely romantic weekend down in Martinique, and as soon as we got there, she turned cold. I mean, it was like, whoa, we're in the same room, but 1,000 miles away. We came back, and I said, what is wrong? And she said, you're crowding me. Well, I know the answer to that. Well, if you think I'm crowding you, you won't have to look for me. Inside, I'm going, That afternoon, I called a friend of mine. He said, well, let's go over and we'll have a couple of drinks. I said, fine. I left my office. I took a $100 bill, stuck it in my wallet. You never can be sure. I'd gotten rid of the kids. They were in summer camp. I was ready for a night on the town. I had an appointment with a judge. I had an appointment with a judge the next morning to plead a guy out. I had worked out a deal for this guy's second DUI. So at 8:30 in the next morning, I was supposed to be in front of the judge with him. And when I got to my friend's office, there was a woman there. And she was a woman who had been in junior high school with me. And she was one of the pretty ones. She was one of the ones I always wanted to be part of. And he said, well, why don't the two of you go on over to the Harley and have a drink, and I'll catch up with you in a few minutes. Well, he never showed up. But after a couple of drinks, a couple of beers, you know, it worked its magic. And I forgot the woman who needed space. And I forgot the fact that I was in love with her, because this felt so good. And we drank, and we drank, and we drank. And I have no idea how much we drank that night. I know that the $100 bill was gone. This was in 1984. About 8 o'clock that night, she said, oh, I've got a son staying with my parents down in Winter Haven, which is about 50 miles south of Orlando. I need to go pick my son up. I said, well, okay, that's not exactly how I thought the night would end, but I understand that. So she left. And all of a sudden, Winter Haven is a very small town. I'll bet that if I drove to Winter Haven, I would meet her. My car would pass her car, she'd see me, and magic would happen. So with that thought, I stopped and picked up two tall cans of beer to take with me, because you can't travel alone. And I drove down Interstate 4 from Orlando toward Winter Haven, and I was in and out of a blackout. I remember bits and pieces of the trip, and, you know, how I didn't kill myself or kill somebody else is an absolute miracle. But I finally got down around Circus World and realized that this was a fool's errand. And so I pulled into a McDonald's to relieve myself, and they had just closed, and I was very upset that they wouldn't let me in special. So I went into an orange grove. I drove into an orange grove, and on the way back out, some paper shifted. I went to pick them up and looked up and saw a tree right in front of me. I turned the wheel, and the car rolled over. And the next thing I knew, I was awake outside the car. I had been ejected out of the car, and the car was on its side. And the radiator was shoved in. And I just woke up, and all I could see in the distance was this light. And somewhere I got the idea that if I get to the light, I'll be okay. and it was a fairly small car, and I pushed it back over. I don't know how I did that. Got in the car and tried to drive to the light. And I got halfway across Interstate 4, and the next thing I remember, there were blue lights. And I took this midnight trip to the Polk County Jail. And the highway patrol kept asking me, he says, just between us, how many do you have? And I went, just two. I was no fool. I wouldn't take the breathalyzer. I wouldn't take the videotape. I knew how to do this. And I started calling my father. He was the only one I knew to call. Would you come down and get me? And he kept hanging up the phone. Finally, at 6 o'clock in the morning on July 25th, 1984, they released me to the dawn of the new day. And I walked out, and my dad picked me up, and he drove me back to Orlando. Got in time, broke into my office because my keys were in the car, ran a razor over my face, kept a jacket and a tie in the office, put it on, and got into court. I got him fooled. I had him fooled. Got through that plea. Judge looked at him and said, young man, this is your second DUI. You've got a problem. But we'd worked it out. We'd worked it out. You know, it looked bad, but he was not hurt. Three years later, I was chairing a meeting in Orlando, and I was in my grunge lawyer look at that time, you know, ripped jeans to show how little I cared for the system. But on that particular day, I was dressed up. I was wearing a coat and tie, and a friend of mine said, doesn't Chet look good dressed up there? And a voice from the back of the room said, he didn't look that good that day in 1984. My client had wandered into the meeting. He was very upset that the judge told him he had a drinking problem because I was standing there looking as bad and smelling worse than he was. Because when I had rolled the car, some of my functions had involuntarily not worked. And I had pooped in my pants. Now, I don't want you to think that there was a big load. But there's something about pooping in your pants. It doesn't take a whole lot to get people's attention. And occasionally when I'm feeling really good, when I'm feeling really slick, I'll see one of those people who was in court that day, and I know who they are, and I go, oh God, I hope the jacket went way down. But I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I didn't think I was an alcoholic because 4 years before that I had quit drinking. I had quit drinking for 4 years before that. I had gotten particularly drunk in Jacksonville with some friends, embarrassed myself mightily, and I just stopped. My wife told me that the reason no one would hire me was because I drank too much. So I quit. And when the good things that I thought would happen to me didn't happen to me, I started drinking again. And I had what is probably the worst thing that can happen to an alcoholic. I had a no consequences drink. I went to a Christmas party and I had a glass of wine. I went to another Christmas party, I had a glass of beer, I went out to dinner and had a glass of beer and wine and went home. No problem. Except a month later, I was driving in a blackout at 2 o'clock in the morning in Orlando, in a town that I'd lived in for 40 years, having no idea where I was, looking for an after-hours bottle club where I could find another drink after the bars had stopped serving. So I was in counseling with a woman that I was dating who wanted space, and I told the counselor the second week that I had had this DUI, and he said, before you come back here to your next meeting, go to AA. And I said, but you don't understand. You don't understand. I don't need to go to AA. I quit drinking for 4 years before on my own, and I can do it again. And he said, go and learn how to ask for help. And I went to one meeting. I pushed it to the very end, the very last day. I went to a meeting at the Central Group in Orlando, Florida. I walked up the steps, And there was a man there with bright blue eyes, white hair, white beard, by the name of Bill Oakley. He allows me to use his last name. He stuck out his hand. He said, "You must be new. Welcome. You'll be comfortable in this room." So he sent me into a room, and a woman was chairing the meeting, a woman by the name of Terry. And she said, in qualifying, I didn't know what she was doing. I just thought she was some floozy from the Bronx. God, what an accent. Fish woman. Turned out she was the red hot mama at Rosie O'Grady's. That brought her up in my estimation when I realized that. But she said, "I never went to a restaurant that didn't serve alcohol." And it hit me right between the eyes. I never went to a restaurant that didn't serve alcohol. Alcohol ordered my life. Every major decision revolved around alcohol. So, not thinking I needed to be in AA, I started going to AA meetings. There was a woman in the meeting, that first meeting, by the name of Mary. She talked about taking some test where, you know, if you're drinking in the morning, blah, blah, blah. Didn't make much sense to me, but I kept seeing her. And I kept going to these meetings. And like I say, sometimes I said I was an alcoholic. Sometimes I said I had a problem with alcohol. But I kept going. I kept going. And there was a group of us that got together after the noon meeting. We'd go out for lunch. There was this woman by the name of Mary. There was another woman by the name of Beverly. There was a couple of guys, and but the three of us were kind of we were the steady members. And for some reason, having friends in AA, they were people that I wouldn't let down. If I drank, I would let them down, and I didn't drink. And I had my kids, and I had to be home at 5 o'clock, 5:30 to make them dinner, and I needed to be there, and I was there. And time went by, and something very bad happened to me. I got comfortable. I was not drinking. I was going to meetings. I had some friends. And that's all I was doing. And I kept hearing about steps, and I kept hearing about God. Now, I didn't think I needed God, because when I went to college, I'd grown up in the Episcopal Church. I'd been an acolyte. But when I went to college, I learned that God and religion were the opiate of the masses, and intelligent people didn't need that. So I rejected religion and God and everything else, but I figured you people were weak enough, you needed it, and that's okay. But after a while, I realized that that was an essential part of the program. And I heard something that hurt me. Now, I don't know if it's true or not, but it hurt me. And what I heard was, if you're having trouble with one step, go back to the one before. Now, the reason why that hurt me was it kept me in limbo, because I expected to get something from these steps. First step was not too difficult. I knew I couldn't control drinking. I was powerless over alcohol. I knew my life was unmanageable. At least I was able to admit it on some superficial level, because I sure as heck didn't intend to end up in an AA meeting at 38 years old. On Saturday morning, we'd sit around and watch Winky Dink. And I never said, in 30 years, I'm going to be in Jekyll Island at an AA meeting. Rah! It wasn't where I was going. So, okay, my life's unmanageable. That second step, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And I kept hearing, that's an important step. You've got to take that step or it doesn't work. And if you take a step and you've really taken it, there should be a sign. Right? You know, the microphone should start squealing. The lights should dim. Rocks should fall out of the sky with messages written on it. Bushes should start to burn, and none of that happened. So maybe I didn't really come to believe. And you make a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand Him. If you make that decision, something should happen. So I did, for a lot of years, what I call the three-step cha-cha. One, two, three, cha-cha-cha. Three, two, one, cha-cha-cha. One, two, three, cha-cha-cha. Three, two, one, cha-cha-cha. I never got off the first step. But I don't want you to think that I was doing nothing. I was doing things. I went to OA. I went to ACOA. I went to any group that ended in a vowel. I went to the Presbyterian Church. I went to the Methodist Church. I went to the Unitarian Church. I went to the Unity Church. I went to the First Church of Religious Science. I read a book called Zen and the Martial Arts. I took Taekwondo to find God. I went into rebirthing, past life regression, channeling. I did Course in Miracles before Course in Miracles was cool. I was a seeker. And at 6.5 years sober, I was no different than I was when the day I walked in. I knew a lot. I could quote the big book. I could quote the 12 and 12. I could talk the talk, but I was not one bit different. Part of my story is I stopped drinking for 4 years. I can tell you that what I got out of not drinking for 4 years without AA and 6.5 years of coming to AA, going to meetings and talking the talk are not one bit different. And so, Christmas of 1990, I had finally found love in AA. I was engaged to be married, and on Christmas Eve, she broke the engagement. On Christmas Eve. I spent Christmas Eve taking her presents back, getting my money back. And it felt good. But I went into a sadness that wouldn't lift. And in February of 1991, I did something because I had a little time on my hands that I had intended to do for a long time, and I went to a Charlie and Joe Big Book study up in Albany, Georgia. And I believe, Bob, you sponsored that. I believe that was another debt that I owe Bob and Ruth. Because when I got there, that's when my sobriety started. They went through the Big Book and showed me what I hadn't seen before. They showed me that the second step was really two questions. Do you now believe, or are you willing to believe, that there is a power greater than yourself that could restore you to sanity? Upon that simple basis, you can make a beginning. Do I now believe? No. Am I willing to believe? Yeah. Move on. Third step. They clarified the third step. I do not believe in rewriting the Big Book. I think it's just fine. But I'm so smart, I have to simplify it a little bit. Otherwise, I'll complicate it. First step, my way don't work. Second step, I think there's a better way. Third step, I think I'll find it. Just that simple. And then I took the inventory. Not my first inventory. My first inventory was taken when I was 3 years sober, and one of the women who was going with me to all of these seekings, and I sat down on her floor, and we sat down with the 12 and 12, the Big Book, the dictionary, the Bible, and most important, the Hazleton Guide. And I wrote an inventory. I wrote 30 pages of drivel. The only good thing I can say about that was I never showed it to anybody. But I got to Georgia, and Charlie and Joe showed me how to do the inventory the way the Big Book says. List the names of people that you're afraid of. List the names and the people that you're mad at. Work through that list. Find out where you have contributed to that, where you have been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking. And I got to tell you, I had 30 pages of people that I was mad at or afraid of. 30 pages. And before you think I'm crazy, I don't mean 30 pages like this. That would really be over the edge. No, it was 30 pages like this. And you can still put a lot of people on a lengthwise page. And I talked to somebody about it. I'd gotten a sponsor, and I talked to him about it. And I started to make the amends. One of the people who was on that list that I was mad at was a man who had been like a second father to me. He had loaned me some money and made it possible for me to move into a house that I couldn't afford, a 3,000 square foot house built around a swimming pool when I had just started my business. And my business did not take off the way I thought it would. And so when it came time to repay him, I basically cheated him out of $5,000. They were wealthy enough that they spend the summers in North Carolina. He allowed me to do the closing, and I manipulated the words in such a way that it wasn't exactly thievery, but it was close enough. And when he came back and was $5,000 short, he was upset with me. Can you believe that? He was going around town calling me a cheat. So he was on my resentment list. I did not want to make amends to that man because that would cost me a lot of money, and I didn't have it. But I got into sobriety, and I hit another wall, and I finally said, am I willing to go to any lengths to do it? And I went to meet with him, and I said, I cheated you. He said, no kidding. I want to pay it back. He said, you don't have to. My wife and I talked about it. We've been very fortunate. You don't have to pay it back. I said, yes, I do. Yes, I do. He said, what are you, a born-again Christian? I went, no, no, not that. I'm an alcoholic. As a result of that conversation, we started talking about one of his children who he was concerned about the drinking. And I told him what I had learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I helped the family take some intervention measures that ultimately worked out pretty well. That person is now in AA and with a couple years sobriety, but there was a period of time there where it didn't look like it was working. Most important, I made amends to my children. I had not been a good father. I had not been a good father because I hadn't been there. I was there physically, but I wasn't there. So one of the things I did was I took my children one at a time out to San Francisco for several days, and they and I spent some time in San Francisco. And they think about that today. San Francisco is still special to them today. But my youngest son was in school up in Georgia. I like to say I found God in Georgia, which for a lifetime gator is a real kick in the rear. But my son was in school. He was going to a military school in Gainesville, Georgia. And one October, I got a letter from the school saying, there's a parents' weekend. We invite you to parents' weekend. And I remember a trip that my father took when I was in military school where he stopped in to see me, and I knew how much that meant to me. And so I made that trip up to Gainesville, Georgia. And I surprised my son. I flew up on a Sunday morning. I surprised him. And we went to church together, and we had dinner together, and we had a good time. And my oldest son came to live with us again. He moved away from me back to his mother, and then in his senior year, he came back to live with me. And we had to throw him out of the house because we told him at the end of the year, no more drugs. And 2 weeks before he graduated from high school, we found drugs in the house, and we had to follow through. And in November of that year, after hanging out and smoking dope and doing things, he came to us and said, I'd like to go to college. And he and I got in a little car, and we drove up through North Carolina, and we went to a little school outside of Charlotte, North Carolina, where he was accepted. And I sat in the university center, where he allowed me to be present. And Gainesville, Georgia, and Monroe, North Carolina are real special places to me. I had spent my entire lifetime going this way. I had been looking for money and women, cars and clothes, thinking that they would give me satisfaction. I did what this program told me. I got in a car and I drove with my sons. I got in an airplane and I drove with my sons. These kids that I really didn't want, didn't have much interest in. These are the experiences that when I think about today, these are the ones that really stand out. Surely there's a power greater than myself that knows better than me what's good for me. As a result of taking those steps, I came to believe that there is a power greater than myself. I make a decision every day based upon that experience that one more time, I'll try to do it your way. When I took that inventory, I realized how unmanageable my life was. I finally gave up on women. That woman that dumped me on Christmas Eve, she and I got back together again and had a relationship for almost an entire year. And in February of 1992, it became obvious that it wasn't working out. Neither one of us were happy. I mean, decent people, just it wasn't there. And I went to her and I said, this isn't working out. And she says, I know. And we said goodbye. And that was on a Tuesday. But, you know, that's kind of a wimpy way to end a relationship. So on Friday, I decided that I would drive over to the beach. And I would walk up and down the beach, a lonely figure, dejected. And people would look at me. And they'd say, oh, what a sad man that is. Now, that's a punctuation mark. And it happened to be a very cold day in February. And there was a cold wind blowing off the ocean. And I don't mind being dramatic, but I'll be damned if I'll be uncomfortable. So I walked down to the ocean and I looked up where he is. And I said, God, I've done the best I can do. I guess I'm not supposed to have a relationship. But if it is your will, if it is your will, would you give me a woman like Mary? Would you give me a woman like Mary? Because she'd been my best friend for 9 years. She'd counseled me on all of my love affairs. I had tried to help her with a marriage. We were good friends, and I just wanted someone like that in my life, if possible. And then I went away. It was too cold, so I went to a movie and came back. And the next morning, the manager of the motel came running out with a piece of paper in her hand. She said, you got this call. And it was a call because Mary was about 10 miles up the coast at a weekend retreat. And it was, come up. And I said, when did this come in? Did it come in last night or did it come in this morning? She said, I don't know. It was just on the answering machine. And so I had to decide, would I drive 10 miles or drive back to Orlando because it's too cold to be dramatic? And I figured, well, what the hell? I'll take the run up and see what's going on. That was February 28, 1992. May 13th of 1992, Mary and I were married. She had to get divorced. That was quick work. Sometimes she says, why don't you ever talk about our wonderful marriage? I said, because I always knew that a good marriage would make me happy. That's no surprise. That's not evidence of a power that knows better than me. What surprises me is that being a father has made me happy. One Saturday morning, in middle of August of last year, I was sitting at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sitting on the ground underneath 12 coconut trees, looking out at the beach of Waikiki. 30 days before that, I had no intention of going to Hawaii. But some tickets had become available, and my youngest son was in the Army in Hawaii. And we said, let's go. And then we extended the invitation to my mother, because my father, when he was in the South Pacific, said that Maui was the most beautiful place he'd ever seen, and he had died 2 years before. And so we extended the invitation to my mother, would you like to go to Hawaii? And we took a helicopter trip up Mount Haleakala, I guess it's, to see this place that my father thought was so beautiful. And at various times, my mother has said, thank you. I could not have made that trip without you. I've been able to make amends to my family. And, you know, I guess what my story is all about is really this. If you are new, get a sponsor. Get someone who has worked the program. Get somebody who understands the steps. get them to take you through the steps. And then look back and see the changes in your life. I spent an entire lifetime of trying to change myself. I spent an entire lifetime of reading self-help books because I knew that of myself I was not enough and that I had to change. And when I worked the steps of the program, and when I say work the steps of the program, I mean when I wrote an inventory, when I talked to somebody about it, when I saw what was objectionable in me, when I tried to make amends for the harm that I had done, I got changed. And I got changed in a way that I never would have done myself. This is a program of change. This is a program. There is so much power in this program that I am so grateful to be here because I shouldn't be here. I should not be here. I should, being a panty-waist drinker who nothing bad ever happened to, I never should have stayed around long enough to learn what I have learned. And I got to tell you this too. I believe that if my story is the same 5 years from now as it is today, I've done something wrong. Because I got a lot to learn. I've got a lot to learn. And when I was 12 years sober, I got a new sponsor. I got a man who I respect. I got a man who has meant a lot to me. And when the first time I called Clancy, I knew how to work the program. I knew how the 10th step worked. I know that it says we've just entered the world of the Spirit. We've got to grow in understanding. It's an overnight matter. It'll last a lifetime. Continue to watch for dishonesty, resentment. I knew that. And I said, I guess you want to hear my resentment and fears. And he said, no, I'm a little more pragmatic than that. I just want to know what you're doing. So the last 4 years, I have written him every Friday and called him every Wednesday and told him what I was doing. And switching the emphasis from feeling to action has made a tremendous difference. Tremendous difference. And so I thank you. And I like the 12 and 12. The 12 and 12 and the 12th step is talking about the spiritual experience. Bill's fumbling with words, I think, trying to define the undefinable. And he said, there are as many definitions of spiritual experience as there are people who have them, but they have one thing in common. And then he goes on to say, we find ourselves possessed of a degree of honesty and tolerance and love that we never thought was possible. What we have received is a free gift. Yet, in some small way, we have made ourselves ready to receive that gift. AA's way of receiving the gift is working the 12 steps. And what I want to thank you all for is showing me by your experience that small way that I am responsible to take so that these things can continue to happen. Thank you all.